Welcome to Making Sheffield, celebrating the Steel City's history and heritage. Our guest today is heritage campaigner Robin Hughes.
There are stories out there, and stories are so important. And of course, there's so many of them, it's a bit overwhelming. Sheffield's a big place, it's been around a long time. And you know, we all have some familiarity with the key stories, like the steel industry and perhaps something about the castle and so on. But there's just so much that has happened here. And actually, there's things that are happening today, nothing's new. That's really what inspired me to look into the history of Pinstone Street. Well, you'll be aware at the moment the council has got a big development project in the city centre, which they call Heart of the City 2. And the first Heart of the City resulted in the Winter Gardens, Millennium Galleries, and of course the revamped Peace Gardens. And it was really very successful. There's a bit of a tendency to think that Sheffield is old and dirty and needs reinventing, and you know, we are the modernisers who are going to do this, but we're not the first people to have a go at that. Every so often it feels like there's a need to do something new to meet the challenges of a new age. And so Pinstone Street to me actually is almost the original Heart of the City project. Now, of course, historically, the heart of Sheffield is not up there at all. It's not where you put your village or your town. It's down by the riverside. That's really where the heart of Sheffield is, where the castle was, where the markets were, where of course the bridge over the river is, without which a town or a village can't function. And it was the Victorians who did so much, in particular the late Victorians, who realised they needed to grasp the nettle and make some really serious changes. If you go back to 1851, you've got a population in the city of about 90,000. So it's already become very highly urbanised. The industries that were primarily based in the river valleys are wonderful, fast-flowing rivers with all those wonderful water mills on them. Those industries are outgrowing where they are, and new processes are coming along. The crucible process has come along. That's fine in a little setting where you've just got the one furnace, but then you need to expand that into the Bessemer process for producing much higher quality steels. You need more space. So the town has started to consolidate, and along with that, of course, have come lots of problems. I listened to my old friend Ron Clayton talking about the flood last week, and he was saying, you know, good old days, what good old days? Conditions in the 19th century were appalling, and he's absolutely dead right. We have not to think of it as a town with a centre where all the business is done. It was just like a village that had got out of hand. So houses were cottages, but they were built in cramped conditions. They had little or no sanitation, no water closets or anything like that. You've got privy middens and ash pits. And just reading the other day, 1893, which is in fact the year Sheffield becomes a city, they're employing a workforce of 500 just to take away the excrement and the ash from these pits. There's a lot of it. So it's a highly insanitary place. So like I said, like a village that's just not being kept under control. And the streets are those of a village as well. So fast forward a little bit to 1871. The population is nearly a quarter of a million by this time, so it's more than doubled in 20 years. The rateable value of the property is £600,000. Just doesn't sound that much, but the minimum you need to multiply to get modern values is about 100. And that's just in terms of the buying power of money. So that's as though a house were a loaf of bread. If you look at it in capital terms, so you think what's kind of the value of that property today as a part of the economy, the multiplier is something like 2,000. So it's already quite a valuable city in terms of rateable value, and that has kept pace with the population, will continue to do so. It's a growing place, but in the 1870s it's still town with the streets of a village. Trams start to run in 1874 to Attercliffe and Carbrook. They're followed in 1877 by, I think, Hillsborough, Netheredge and Healy. But they can't go through the town. The streets are too narrow. High Street is, you know, less than half the width it is now. And Pinstone Street doesn't actually exist in its current form. So in 1875, The council, and they do this a number of times, so this is really the big one, they get parliamentary powers to remodel what is then the town centre, because it's not yet a city. And rather modestly, they refer to what they're going to do as street improvements. Well, this is the moment. What they're about to do is to move the entire heart of the city from where it's been historically, down in the markets area, all the way up the hill to where we see the town hall now. I think where the old town hall is, that was positioned appropriately for where the town really was at the time. And even when it was built, this is a typical Sheffield thing, even when it was built, it wasn't really big enough. So they'd outgrown it. So one of the things they will have had in their minds, will the council, is our town hall is not good enough for us. We're far more important than that. We want a nice big new one. But really they wanted a nice big new town to go with it. So they create three major new streets. They create Leopold Street, they create Surrey Street, and they create Pinstone Street. Pinstone Street is the biggest, and I think it's really the first to be fully developed. And that's actually going to be the story for today. This is the heart of the city project, late 19th century style. So what you've got to imagine is the middle of the town is close to the river. You come up High Street and Fargate, and Fargate is Fargate because it is the far gate in the sense of way rather than a barrier. So it's the distant one. This is where the town ends, and you've got Barker's Pool in what was then called Upper Fargate at the very top. And of course it's at the top because the water needs to flow downhill. There are some cottages and industries starting to emerge there, but it's, historically it's not anything other than like the edge of the town. Where the Peace Gardens are now, you've got St. Paul's Church, a very fine Georgian church built in the early 18th century, demolished in 1938 because it was surplus to requirements. That really was the end of the town in that direction. And as for Pinstone Street itself, if you stand in the Peace Gardens and look downhill towards Moorhead, you'll see there's a great kink to the right as it goes down there. And that's because it's deviated from its old line. It used to be just a little alleyway going through ramshackle back-to-backs in the area of what was then called New Church Street, which has been extinguished now, called New Church Street because it was for St. Paul's Church, which at the time was the new church, because the parish church was no longer big enough, really. So it's a little alleyway going along there and carrying on in a straight line. So it eventually hits Union Street. And it's just a typical little back street full of all kinds of businesses. I seem to remember there being a lot of butchers down there. There's also a leech dealer, of all things, even a firework maker. It's a real higgle-piggle of all kinds of different trades and businesses going on. Nobody really knows why it's called Pinstone. It's variously referred to as Pinstone Street, Pinstone Lane, Pinstone Croft Lane, Pinson Croft. The only story I really remember, I don't know if it's true, is it did also have the name Pinching Croft or Pinching Croft Lane. And that was something to do with a game whereby you threw sticks at a chicken, and if the chicken fell over, you won the chicken. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's the one that sticks in the mind. There aren't many other Pinstones around the country as a whole. So their vision was, instead of having a choice of the old way that went up to the top of Barker's Pool and then down Cambridge Street, which is also steep and quite narrow and a difficult road, that's the ancient way out of the town, or the slightly newer way along Norfolk Street, which is still quite narrow and has had recently to be widened, they'll carve this great sway through and create a new, almost a boulevard, a great new civic street for government and for commerce. And this is going to be key to Sheffield's success. Traffic will be able to flow freely through it. They'll attract better investors, build a better class of building. They plan to transform the town. And whether in 1875 they were thinking in these terms, I don't know. But in 1893, the 50th anniversary of Sheffield becoming a corporation, in 1893 it becomes a city for the first time. And they probably had some ambitious thought of they wanted to jump up the status of the city. They didn't just want it to be a dirty old manufacturing town. They wanted it to be the place to be seen. Pinstone Street is right at the core of that vision. So we'll scroll forward a little bit to 1882. The way they're going to do this, by the way, is they've got these parliamentary powers, so effectively they can buy land pretty much as they like. So they're going to buy the land they need to widen the streets, clear it, create new plots, auction these off, and that's how they'll recoup some of the money. They know that it's not going to make a profit. They're looking for the future, and eventually it will pay for itself for the city as a whole and in rateable value, that kind of thing. But actually, there's another sidetrack. Recently, when they were talking about the Midland Station redevelopment, they're talking about a plan that would be the biggest ever, because it would have a value of something like 1.5 billion. I mean, even the heart of the city too is half a billion. These are big schemes. The amount of money that they spent just on buying the land for this Victorian scheme, if you do it on the usual basis for projects, works out just over a billion in today's terms, using the 2000 multiplier. This is big stuff. And those three streets are just the start of it. There's 11 others they're enlarging. They're going to have to widen Fargate and High Street. There's a lot going on. 1882, they've assembled quite a bit of land and they start to auction it off. And it does not go particularly well. It's already the sixth sale. They've been selling bits here and there. This is a bigger one. They're selling 40 plots and nearly half of these are on Pinstone Street. They've got an auctioneer who becomes, there's a wonderful account of it in the Telegraph, I think it is. He becomes gradually more and more disheartened as he goes through the sale. Nothing, they start at the end where the town hall is now, and they simply cannot sell anything. Nothing reaches its reserve, some things are not bid for at all. Finally, they get to the site on the corner of Charles Street and Pinstone Street, and they find a buyer for it. It doesn't quite reach the reserve, but they're desperate by this time. So they sell it to a chap called Henry Bacon Atkinson. Now, it's not that Atkinson. It's not the down the bottom of the moor Atkinsons, although coincidentally, his father did start off as a draper, his father, William. William did very nicely for himself. He became an accountant and property speculator, and he had four sons. One would also be an estate agent. Two would form Atkinson Brothers Cutlery firm, and there's a mayor and a master cutler in there as well. Henry trains as a pharmacist, but in 1874 his dad dies, and so he inherits quite substantially. So he's in his late 20s, he's living in Totley Brook, so the posh end, not even a town, because it's in Derbyshire then. And he's young. I quite like him. He creates a mental picture of somebody who's young and impetuous and hasn't really learned where the boundaries are yet. So, you'll start a development project and then get fined for not getting the right council permission, that kind of thing. His schemes will change as they're underway. But he's nothing if not a go-getter, and he sees an opportunity. This land is going cheap. Today, things are not going terribly well, but in the future, this is going to be the heart of the city. So he buys that plot. The rest of the sale goes equally badly. Further down the bottommost plot, on the pointy bit between Pinstone Street and Cambridge Street, initially that doesn't sell, but they do eventually sell it to another chap called William Henry Britton. Now, these are both important players, I reckon, in the history of Sheffield as we know it today. Britton is almost the opposite of Atkinson, except that they're both wealthy, because Britton... You could almost say he is municipal Sheffield personified. He's a councillor, he's about to become an alderman, he's a manufacturer of I think wire, steel, that kind of thing at Alma Works in Barker's Pool. He's got a lovely big house out at Ranmore called Storth Oaks. And he probably buys this plot in the end because he feels it's his civic duty to do so. Those are the only two plots in Pinstone Street that sell. Everything else is pretty much a wasteland. It's either been cleared or it's waiting to be cleared. Of course, something else about Atkinson and his purchase. One of the things that may have sold it to him is it included the license for the Rubens Head. So he saw that he could inherit a license and he exploited that. The building he put on that site was the Athol Hotel. Now, the Athol no longer exists, but it really is the point at which I think Sheffield goes from being this dirty manufacturing town to a town about to become a city with a bit of vision. But the road to this is not that smooth. It's going to be 1883, so not that much later, that Atkinson is able to build the Athol. But in the meantime, the council get themselves into a fight with the authorities at St. Paul's Church over who exactly should pay for relocating the wall of the churchyard. And this is a great illustration of how fond Sheffielders are of their history, and also, I'm afraid, the extent to which we're able to harbour a grudge. Because they, in criticising the church authorities, they bring up the matter of the church authorities having failed to appoint an incumbent to that church. But this is when it was first built. This is 150 years earlier, and they're still dragging this up as a stick to beat the church authorities with. So they've not forgotten, and now, but anyway, they managed to resolve that. Over the summer, they get into an internal squabble about the paving of the street. And there's a lot of stress. And I think we need to understand why there is a lot of stress and why things are going so badly. The period from 1873 to 1896, approximately, is known as the Long Depression. The economy was in a dreadful state. And it was in a, so again, not very dissimilar to today. Grand new building, trying to do this in the middle of very poor economic times. What had happened, the economists, you know, two economists, three opinions, there are lots of different explanations, but the one that's most compelling is that America moved from a combined gold and silver standard for valuing their currency to just the gold. So the bottom fell out of the silver market at a time when large new deposits were being discovered. So that's just a shock to the world economy. It's seen as really the first time the world has suffered a worldwide economic shock. And we're right in the middle of it trying to rebuild the town. So the council hold their nerve, but they are a bit stroppy from time to time with each other because they're buying all this land, they're having to borrow money to buy it, and it's not going anywhere. So you can understand now why Britain might have felt he should be investing as well. So 1883, Atkinson manages to get the Athol up. 1884, it's followed by the building we now call the Pepper Pot, which has just had been removed apart from its facade, but the facade and the roofscape will form part of the new development. And then later on in 1884, they managed to sell the plot in between, the building that until not so long ago was an HSBC bank. Sell that to another mover and shaker, Charles Henry Malham. Now, Malham was a gun manufacturer. He had a little shop in West Bar, but he also had a shop in London, Regent Street, I think. So, you know, he's got the metropolitan touch. And actually, his firearms are still sought after. They're still available for sale from collectors or to collectors. So he wasn't a really big property speculator, but he partnered up with a stockbroker called Hardy to build what's actually a very splendid building there, which has also been facaded. And when he died in the 1930s, 34, I think it was, he still owned half the building. So he left it to the town trustees, and the proceeds were to be used for buying art for the city's collection, which had happened. There is a Malham bequest. There are pictures in it, including a couple of Turners and a Sir Peter Lely. So, you know, these people are also thinking about their legacy and about being benefactors. The Athol opens. It's a great success. Atkinson has had huge foresight. In 1884, May, I think, he manages to persuade the Sheffield Football Association to start having their dinners there. This is at the end of the season, so they've got winners with trophies and medals to be presented. And conveniently, in one of the shops on the ground floor, there's an Athletic Outfitters, so of course they can be displayed there. So he's seen the business opportunity. And shortly after that, chair for that meeting was John Charles Clegg, I believe. And Clegg, all ramifications everywhere, all these things connect together. Clegg was a big guy in Sheffield football. He's really important. I think he is the one who goes on to become both president and chairman at different times of the National Football Association. He's an important person. Anyway, he's chairing the meeting there at that time. Then in July, they form the Sheffield Cricket Association. there. A couple of years later, the Conservative Party moves in, becomes pretty well established. You go on to 1889, the Sheffield District Football League is formed there. Not the earliest league, it would be nice to have that, but quite early on. I mean, leagues, I think, started in about 1888. So a lot is going on in these premises. But apart from that, the shops built by the other chaps further down the hill, there's nothing on Pinstone Street, apart from St. Paul's Church, which is there already, all the way up to Barker's Pool. There's just one building on the corner, Town Hall Chambers, put up by architect J.B. Mitchell Withers. I should just say something about the Pepper Pot. Britton built the Pepper Pot, and he got in a very noted firm of Sheffield architects, Flockton and Gibbs. Flockton, not that Flockton, but his father, William, was the architect for King Ted's School, and also the Mount nearby, which looks very similar. And T.J. Flockton partnered with Edward Gibbs, and they were very successful. They had a lot of business in the city, did a lot of survey work, and ended up building quite a lot of Pinstone Street. Anyway, things have come to a bit of a screeching halt on Pinstone Street. 1884, a building goes up then. Nothing happens for 6 years. Buses are started to be rerouted that way. That's probably the big excitement. There is development elsewhere, but the West Bar expansion, that's stalled, and that gets the council into a further argument with a property owner because they've had to pay him to set back his property. Then it hasn't gone ahead, so they're having to compensate him for not having set back his property. They get into a spat with Pawson and Brailsford on High Street over something similar because the High Street widening's not going ahead. It's all, you know, looking a bit dodgy. Then finally in 1890, they get a bit of good news. The Sally Army are in town. And they have decided to buy the plot on the corner of Crossburgess Street and Pinstone Street. So that's opposite the Peace Gardens where we see the Citadel today, Pinstone Chambers with the huge turrets on the corner. So that's the Sally Army. Now they're controversial. They were in Sheffield in 1882 and they don't do anything quietly. So they are having what they call it, Holiness Convention, I think that was what they called it. And they always have, you know, band processions and marches and that kind of thing. In 1882, there was a near riot. They were pelted with stones and mud and other nasty substances. They were seen by some people, still not entirely clear why to me, as a threat. I mean, it may have been their temperance attitude. It may just have been this rather in-your-face way they had. 1890, Sheffield is a lot keener on them. They've got used to the idea. Maybe they see them as being, you know, Sheffield's got this rebellious past thing of, we do a lot of non-conformism, we do a lot of not doing what the others do. So we may actually have seen them as being a bit more in our spirit than we thought in the first place. 1890 anyway, they say they're going to build a new barracks, as they call it, on that corner plot. And they have a flag hoisting ceremony. But there's a contemporary description when they do eventually start building, which is a couple of years later. Somebody writes in one of the papers to say how badly they are keeping their building site. But this is really just a way of then neatly segueing into a blistering critique of the Improvement Committee, who are the part of the council responsible for all this, because they've still all got all these vacant sites and premises falling down about them. There's talk of people either refusing to walk down Pinstone Street or holding their noses and hitching up their skirts so they don't have to tread in the sewage that's collecting there. It's not a nice place. So the fact that somebody now wants to build there is absolutely great. Because the only thing they've managed to do in the meantime is dig up the surplus earth and take it out to Crooks Valley and use it to build the embankment. But finally, things are restarting. This seems to be the starting gun. By the way, the Sally Army are okay in Sheffield, but in 1891, there's a similar riot in Eastbourne. So they're by no means part of society at this point. Anyway, they have this flag hoisting celebration. And at the same time, same year, 1890, they finish a competition for who's going to build the new town hall where it is now. It's run by E.W. Mountford, who's a London architect, a very, very major London architect. This does not go down well with Flockton and Gibbs, who come second and feel that a local architect should have built it. The budget for this hall is £80,000. Again, if you want to get some ideas to what that means today, multiply by somewhere between 100 and 2,000, and it's probably nearer the 2,000 end. There's a press comment. Again, nothing changes. The press immediately predict it will go over budget, which I don't think it does by much. And they're pleased to notice that there will finally be proper accommodation for the press. They're delighted about that. And then another argument breaks out, this time between Flockton and Gibbs and Mountford, because they allege that he's infringed a provisional patent of theirs for a scheme of arranging the interior of the town hall so that the public cannot get access where they are not wanted, which I thought was rather telling. Anyway, nothing comes of that. It's, you know, it's all, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing. But they do get a bit of a consolation prize to Flockton and Gibbs, because another big player in the town this time is Reuben Thompson. He's our local transport entrepreneur, and he does a bit of everything. You know, he runs omnibuses, he runs old-time coach trips out into the Peak District, he does weddings and funerals, of course, and special excursion vehicles. And he needs new premises. He's down, I think, he might be down at Moorhead. Anyway, he needs somewhere new, and he also sees this is the new heart of the city. So he takes a plot more or less opposite where St. Paul's was and where the Peace Gardens are now. He's going to keep his carriages and his horses there. And his horses are going to live upstairs. And later on, he solves the problem of taking his carriages upstairs as well. It's not the only place where horses go upstairs. It's actually quite a commonplace thing. So this is going to be his new depot, effectively his bus station and his transport hub. And he's going to do something quite new. He's going to build apartments on the upper floors, but he's going to aim them at working families. Again, this is all part of the transformation. Sheffield goes from being this little place full of cottages that have somehow all got crushed together and have got no sanitation. Now working families are going to be offered city living. And he knows it's going to be a city. He starts in 1892. He opens in 1893. And he calls his premises City Mews. He's got an eye for being first, has Reuben. There's a very widely shared photograph of him with the city's first motor taxi some years later, taking Sir John Bingham as a passenger. And it's obviously posed. You know, Bingham's in his full morning dress. And Reuben Thompson, who probably hasn't driven a taxi for a while, he's actually got up as a taxi driver with a cloth cap and the full forelock tugging act. But you can see this is a bit more publicity. These people knew how to sell themselves. So anyway, he opened City Mews in 1893, and the flats go very well. There's 9 of them, and it's reckoned they could have been sold half a dozen times over. So this gives the Salvation Army an idea. They had been going to have shops below, offices above, citadel around the corner. And if you look at the original plans, you'll see that all the officers are having office crossed out and apartment written in instead. They've seen that this is something that's worth doing. So that's why there are people living in Pinstone Chambers now. They were going to be offices, but they became apartments from an early date. So Sally Army also managed to start building in 1892. They opened in 1894. And round about that time, another piece in the puzzle comes in, and this is the bit between, this is almost opposite the town hall. This is Palatine Chambers. And this time, Flockton and Gibbs are the architect, as they actually were for Reuben Thompson. Gibbs is putting his money where his mouth is. Gibbs is an investor in this scheme, along with a chap called Laycock, who we'll meet later on. It wasn't until very recently I understood why Palatine Chambers might have been called Palatine Chambers. Now, obviously, it's got this kind of air of governance and prestige and importance, but there's something else going on here. Sheffield, as everybody knows, is built on 7 hills, depending how you count them, and so, of course, is Rome, and so was ancient Rome. Now, the principal hill in ancient Rome was the Palatine Hill, where, according to legend, Romulus and Remus were suckled by the she-wolf. So there's no evidence for this, but I think they were trying to create that kind of a sense. Sheffield almost as the new Rome. We're on seven hills like they are, and we're going to be as great as they are, and we're going to call our building, which is right opposite where the big new town hall is going to be, right in the thick of things, we're going to call it Palatine Chambers. So that opens in 1895. That's also successful. Reuben Thompson expands his premises. This is where he manages to solve the problem of putting his carriages in a lift and taking them upstairs. And then all you've got left is one little corner plot next to the Athol. So just as that area was the first, so it'll be the last. This is where Laycock House is. Laycock is James Laycock, who was Gibbs's partner for Palatine Chambers. He actually lives in Scarborough. He's not one of the local Laycocks. And until they demolished the Athol Hotel, you could actually see right there in two buildings a complete encapsulation of this process of starting as a little grubby town and becoming the big ambitious new city. The Athol's quite cautious. It actually looks rather like a suburban pub. It had Tudor-style cladding, which was added in the 1920s, which made it look a little bit better, but also made it look rather out of place. Next door to it got Laycock House, which is flamboyant and confident. It looks almost Parisian in its style. It's got huge display windows. This is meant to make a statement. So from 1883 to 1896, this is where we've come, from building quite provincial, suburban-looking architecture to stuff which, apart from its small size, would not be out of place in any capital anywhere. That's how much the city's confidence has grown. And we're coming out of recession. The Long Depression is pretty much over in 1896. And that means the whole of that side of the street, and by the way, on the other side as well, has now been developed. There's premises everywhere. The town hall is up. It's officially opened in 1897, I think, by Queen Victoria, although she doesn't leave her carriage. But it's been in use really for since the mid-1890s. And so really that is what makes Pinstone Street the new heart of the city, the equivalent project of its day, and the step from the old to the new. And of course today it's antique. People like me are fighting to preserve it with some but limited success. It's a lot better than it was going to be. If you go back 20 years and look at the very first plans for what was to become the new retail quarter, which of course never happened, you'll really see it looks as though everything's going. And actually, if you go back further still, 1945, in the post-war spirit, there's a document called Sheffield Replanned, and that really was going to be a complete reinvention of the city centre. There was going to be a huge civic plaza where Pinstone Street and Burgess Street and Cambridge Street now are. It would have been a huge open space, with the town hall and city hall, frankly, looking rather dwarfish in amongst that little lot. And then, of course, that was also, that continued into the plans in the 1960s, but that area didn't really get touched. I think what's got us to the point where the city really looks like it is today is actually in 1959, the council finally realised they are not going to get their civic plaza. So they sell or lease, I forget which, the land to John Lewis, who already owned Coles. So they say, right, we've decided it's not going to be the civic area, it is going to be the retail area. So there is an argument for saying 1959 is when the first idea for the retail quarter comes about. Anyway, over the last 20 years, it's been a bit of a war of attrition, but we're keeping all the facades down Pinstone Street now, and all of Laycock House. The news is substantially better on Cambridge Street, which is part of the same project. So actually we feel that we've gone from pushing water uphill to actually perhaps having managed to store some of it in a tank on the way. The only thing you can't see is the Athol Hotel, because that, unfortunately, it wasn't of huge architectural merit. And the process of getting the idea across that it's the stories that attach to the building as much as the appearance of the building itself, that's actually a relatively new idea. And maybe if we'd started that argument 20 years ago, we'd have won it. But actually, I only really started looking into that a couple of years ago. Really, by that time, it was too late. But, you know, the council have cracked on and they've listened to the need, for example, to keep facades. It's a start. It's not marvellous, but it'll do. So the pepper pot down the bottom, the facade has stayed, and they are going to rebuild the roofscape. That's in the plans. That's under development right now. You'll see the cranes up and the concrete cores going up behind it. And the roofscape will come back, as it will on the Malham and Hardy building next door to that. The Athol is being replaced with a new building about which opinion, shall we say, is somewhat mixed. Laycock House is being refurbished as apartments with shops below, so that's keeping its original purpose. Pinstone Chambers and the Citadel are not in scope of Heart of the City 2. All we can say is the Citadel is listed and everybody regards it as a fine building. So there's been a series of applications by third parties to develop that. Nothing's really come to fruition, and I think what might kickstart that is seeing other buildings going up around. City Mews and Palatine Chambers, the application's in at the moment, and will come to committee sometime in the next few months. That's going to be a hotel. That's going to be the Radisson Blue. So that's another facade job, so everything behind. Most of what was behind those facades has gone anyway, and they were decapitated in the 1970s. City Mews was never very big, but Palatine Chambers used to have this marvellous roof, which has gone. That will be replaced with a modern-looking roof. I'm slightly unusual in that actually I quite like it. I know there are other people who equally hate it, and the only thing I will say is that it's always too early to make up your mind about a new building. You're asking me again in 50 years' time, and I'll tell you what. I didn't like the Peace Gardens when I first saw them. I think they're marvellous now. So, you know, you can be wrong at first, or, of course, your gut instinct can be right. So Pinstone Street and its external appearance won't be very different to how it's been since the late 1900s, which says something about the quality of the architecture down there. As you move further west, John Lewis is staying. And if you look round the back on Burgess Street, you've got the Lion's Lair, the Yorkshireman's Arms. That's privately owned. We don't know what's happening to that. We're hoping very much that will not get overwhelmed, but it's not part of the council's plans. You've got Barker's Pool House, which is a late 60s, early 70s block. And that had a frieze by the sculptor William Mitchell, who died recently. Sheffield has two William Mitchells. Neither of them are his top-notch listable work, but there are a lot of his works that are in that category elsewhere. I think doors of Liverpool Cathedral, I think, are down to him. Also a rather odd statue of Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, which used to be in Harrods, with very much outside his normal style. But that frieze has been carefully taken down and kept by the council, and they have promised they will re-erect it within the Heart of the City too, somewhere. See, that's quite recent. That's only 50 years old. And a lot of people will have said, this is terrible modern art. It's abstract. You can't see what it is. Now we're starting to see it as a heritage asset, as something that, even if we're not quite sure about it yet ourselves, it's not for us to say that it doesn't matter and it has no value. We'll leave it for a new generation to make that decision. I'm actually like a lot of Sheffield historians. I mean, this really came into focus with Ron last week. He's a great storyteller. He likes to tell it as a drama. And I'd like the same thing as well. It's telling it as a story. Now, I've got a little quotation here, which really took my fancy. And it's from Philip Pullman. And he says, after nourishment, shelter and companionship, stories are the thing we need most in the world. Right now, that's really, really important. I was talking to Mike Drabble, the council's heritage champion, the other day, and his big thing is what people are looking for after the pandemic is safety, a sense of safety and security. You might not be able to achieve absolute safety, but that sense of feeling rooted in your environment, where you live, knowing where you belong in it, just give you that sense of confidence to maybe venture out and try things. It's safety that's needed. And feeling that you're part of a story, that you know your surroundings, is part of creating that sense of safety. At the outset, I described myself as a heritage campaigner, and it's very easy to think of heritage people as people who just want to preserve everything in aspic, keep things as they have been for ages. Of course, everything changes. I've just been talking about nothing but change. Heritage is not the past. Heritage is the ongoing story. So we in turn are going to tell our part in that story, and we're going to be leaving things which are going to be heritage for the future. So my focus as a heritage campaigner is making sure the story doesn't get interrupted, so it carries on as a single narrative. No pages get torn out, no chapters get lost. So it's all one story that you can see. We know that there will have to be change, there will be new things, and some of the things we celebrate the most were new once. So cautiously, we need to welcome the new, but at the same time, we need to make sure it connects with what there is, and that will keep the story alive for all of us.